Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have a fabulous guest on the show today for a really important and high-yield talk. And not only is he a wonderful guest, but he's a former resident and current colleague, and how fun is that? I have with me Dr. Eric Wang. Eric is an associate clinical professor at Johns Hopkins in the Division of Pain Medicine. He previously served as the program director of the Pain Medicine Fellowship and currently holds appointed committee positions with both the American Society of Anesthesiologists and the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. His clinical and research interests focus on spine pain and neuropathic pain, and he practices in both anesthesiology and interventional pain management. Now, we're going to talk about some very highly tested autonomic blocks. And this is because anyone who has taken oral boards knows that these things come up all the time. You may not be a pain doctor, you may never do these blocks, but you need to know them at the very least for your exams. And we're going to go over those ones that come up a lot on tests, so that you know what you need to know, not to be a trained pain medicine doctor. You obviously have to do a fellowship for that, but so you at least know a little bit about these things and can get the questions right on exams. So I'm excited to have Eric here to help us with that. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jed. It's really my pleasure.
Well, let's start by telling us a little about you. So I mentioned you were a resident here, and we were thrilled to have you stay on faculty when you finished your residency. Tell me a little bit about how you decided to pursue a career in pain medicine.
I think all of us, when we decide to go into the healthcare field, we all wanted to relieve suffering in some way through our different specialties or different skill sets. This is what I think all of us want to do deep down inside in some way. And I think before we all start clinical training, everyone knows that suffering is more than just the physical aspects. There's also the spiritual, mental, emotional, and social components as well. And I think hospitals, to their credit, recognize this because there are services that they offer for each of these components. But I think ironically, as we all progress in our training and our expertise, our view often becomes inadvertently very reductionist. It becomes to be only about the physiology, the diagnosis or the treatment or the pathology at hand. And we kind of lose sight of the bigger picture of what is leading to a person's overall suffering. And I think the structure of the healthcare system of 15 to 20 minutes per patient certainly does not help. And I feel that pain medicine as a field is very unique and meaningful, because even though the specific diagnoses or a particular individual are, of course, directly pain-related, a truly great treatment plan will also involve other components of the patient's overall suffering, such as having people from physical therapy weigh in, or psychiatry or psychology, perhaps even social services. You really have the opportunity to have a multidisciplinary plan for a patient and address all these different facets of suffering, and also perhaps unique among most anesthesia specialties, because you get to know the patients over a long period of time, you can have a very individualized plan and try to tailor these options in the best way that you believe would be helpful because you've gotten to know that person.
Yeah, fabulous. I love that. And I think that that's a real draw for a lot of people into the specialty. Let's talk about some of the background for the autonomic blocks that we're going to talk about. So how are autonomic blocks relevant to relieving pain?
So afferent nerves from the viscera travel alongside and eventually converge along the sympathetic ganglia and the plexuses of the sympathetic chain. So they commingle and they join together at some point along their path. And so therefore, if you block those ganglia or the plexuses, it does two things. Number one, it interrupts this nociception or the transmission of pain from the viscera. And number two, the sympathetectomy from blocking the sympathetic ganglia or plexus leads to direct and indirect analgesic effects. So because of that, these blocks are used for number one, visceral pain conditions, and number two, for sympathetically maintained pain. One example would be certain subtypes of CRPS.
All right. So when we talk about visceral pain, we're talking about, for example, cancer pain, right, in the abdomen or pelvis or wherever the cancer is. And then, as you said, there's the sympathetically maintained pain like CRPS, which is obviously not from cancer, but from something else that we call CRPS. Okay. So that's what these blocks are for. And what is the rest stop analogy?
So the rest stop analogy is something I came up with. If you imagine the sympathetic chain, you have two chains, one on both sides of the body. So it's a bilateral system. It goes all the way from head to toe, basically, but along the spine. And you can imagine each plexus or a ganglia as being a rest stop that the nerves and the immediate area have to rest at or plug into before the signals then eventually reach the spinal cord. So if you were to block one of these rest stops, then you can, if you can imagine traffic being around the rest stop and all the cars have to go through that rest stop first, then you can really cause a big traffic jam if you block that particular rest stop in the immediate area. And now if you do something like a neurolysis in that you cause really big damage to the road going into the rest stop, then you can cause a really long-term traffic jam.
Right. And in this analogy, the traffic jam, the traffic are the signals, right? The pain signals that are traveling along those fibers.
That's correct.
Great. All right. And so you mentioned that, this is going through the sympathetic chain, the sympathetic ganglia. So are all of these blocks that we're going to talk about sympathetic in nature?
It's a great question. So the vast majority of the ganglia that we'll be talking about today are sympathetic ganglia. But the one exception is the spinopalatine ganglion, which is also sometimes on the board exams. And that one is unique because the spinopalatine ganglion is a parasympathetic ganglion. So therefore, the title of the talk for our discussion today is autonomic blocks, but this one particular ganglion is parasympathetic.
Great. Okay, so we'll get to that. Let's start with the stellate ganglion block. This is something that for sure comes up on tests. So tell us a little bit about that. What are the indications for the stellate ganglion block?
Yeah, so for all the blocks in general, I'm going to try to hone down on three particular topics that most procedure-based questions were asked about: indications, anatomic key points, and complications. So to start things off with the stellate ganglion block, the classic indication is CRPS, or complex regional pain syndrome, of one of the upper extremities. But sometimes in the boards and also in real life, some other indications that you might see might be VT storm, or in other words, refractory ventricular tachyarrhythmias, PTSD, phantom limb pain, or COVID-related anosmia. Sometimes the stellate ganglion block is also used for refractory pain from vascular insufficiency or hyperhidrosis as well. But again, the classic indication is CRPS of the upper extremity.
Great.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think this is really key. This comes up all the time. CRPS itself is highly tested, and of course, the treatment for it, and in this case, this block. So great. That's the indication you're probably going to see. And then you mentioned some other ones. The COVID-related anosmia is a really interesting one. And I wonder, as questions from the COVID time get worked into the test, if we're going to start seeing that more. That's really interesting. Now we're going to start by telling us a little bit about the anatomy that may come up. What did we need to know about the anatomy?
Yeah, so one of the most tested items about the stellate ganglion block is where the block is actually placed, which is specifically at the C6 tubercle, or the eponym that is often on the exams is the Chastinex tubercle. So it's a French eponym. And the importance of the C6 tubercle is that the vertebral artery is actually shielded by the transverse process at that level, in that when you perform the procedure, the needle is usually blocked by that bone. So it's a level of safety to prevent the needle from getting into the vertebral artery. So that's why that anatomic point is often tested.
Okay, so the stellate ganglion itself is C7 to T1, but you're going in at C6 because it's a little safer.
That's correct. The stellate ganglion is a fusion of two smaller plexuses along C7 to T1. But because of the vertebral artery, many practitioners do the injection at C6. So it's close by, but not actually close enough to get into the vertebral artery, or at least that's the goal.
Okay, great. So speaking of getting into the vertebral artery, something we don't want to do, that's obviously one of the complications if you get it wrong. What do we worry about with that, and what are some other complications?
Yeah, so this is another key point that's tested on exams, is that if you do inadvertently enter the vertebral artery, even a small volume of local anesthetic, and I might mean as small as 0.2 milliliters, something really minute, because of how close the vertebral artery is to the cerebral circulation, you can cause a seizure. And the examiners love to test this because if a patient on a stem has a seizure after a stellate ganglion block, the knee-jerk reaction might be to think, oh, maybe the patient's having local anesthetic systemic toxicity or LAST. So then you might, in your mind, go down the treatment algorithm, the LAST algorithm by Azra, and start thinking about intralipid on the exam, for example. However, in this context, the important thing is to recognize that the seizures are self-limited and separate and distinct from LAST. Patients can get LAST from a stellate ganglion, that's true. But in the context of an exam, they're probably testing you to know that a small volume of local can cause a seizure. And the treatment and management is to treat the seizure, number one, by giving in benzodiazepine. And number two, supporting the airway if the patient becomes apneic, which again should be temporary, but you might have to do positive pressure ventilation and optimize oxygenation and ventilation. But you see, this is very different from going down the treatment algorithm of using intralipid and the LAST algorithm.
Yeah, great. That's really important. Okay, so that's a big one to know. What other complications should we be aware of?
So other complications that could occur are laryngeal nerve or phrenic nerve blockade, just because those nerves run pretty close to the stellate ganglion. And if you were to block them bilaterally and you were to have bilateral laryngeal nerve or phrenic nerve blockade, then this can really cause issues with breathing. So bilateral blocks are contraindicated. And you can also enter the esophagus or epidural space or intrathecal space with the stellate ganglion block just because you're working in the neck. So just other potential side effects, complications to be aware of.
Great. Okay. Other things we should know about this block?
So the Horner syndrome is something that occurs with a stellate ganglion because, again, you are doing a sympathetic block. The stellate ganglion is a sympathetic ganglion. So if you were to block it, you cause a sympathetectomy, therefore the Horner syndrome. So it's not really a complication, actually, in this particular context. It's something that is expected. So you have the classic ptosis, anhidrosis, and meiosis that occurs with the Horner syndrome. And you would also recognize that the ipsilateral upper extremity, the temperature would go up. This is because when you cause a sympathetic blockade, you cause vasodilation as a consequence, and the increased blood flow makes the arm warmer. This is also why one of the secondary indications I mentioned earlier were regarding pain from vascular insufficiency. Sometimes you are intentionally causing this increased vasodilation to treat pain from ischemia.
Great. All right. That was really great. High yield. Let's move to another often tested block, the celiac plexus block. And let's go through those same things. What are the indications for a celiac plexus block?
The most common indication is abdominal cancer-associated pain. And among that category, most commonly from pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. So that is where I've seen it the most, is a question about pancreatic cancer pain, though, as you say, it could be other pain in the abdomen from different cancers. But I do think the most likely way this will come up is pancreatic cancer. All right. And so what is the anatomy we need to know for this one?
The anatomical considerations can help you to distinguish this block, the celiac plexus block, from some of the other blocks we'll talk about a little bit later in this talk today. But the T5 to T12 visceral afferents all eventually plug into the celiac plexus. So therefore, not just the pancreas, but the viscera from the GI tract all the way from the stomach through the transverse colon, if you have cancer pain from any of these structures within that distribution, these could all benefit from a celiac plexus block. And from the T5 to T9, those nerves converge into what's called the greater splenic nerve. The T10 and T11 nerves plug into the lesser splenic nerve, and the T12 nerve is also called the lesser splenic nerve as they all approach the celiac plexus. And the celiac plexus itself, that ganglion itself, is at T12 to L1. And even though we oftentimes think of it as a midline structure, because it is, technically there is a left and a right celiac plexus ganglion, but they're just intermeshed together in front of the aorta.
Okay. Yeah. And man, in front of the aorta should scare anybody, right? So that is obviously going to be related to the potential adverse effects. So what do we think of in terms of effects that will come from this and adverse effects that we want to try to avoid?
So the two most common effects that we see on exams are number one, orthostatic hypotension, and number two, diarrhea. And these two occur because, again, you cause a sympathetic blockade, so the parasympathetic function is in overdrive. So because of that, you have vasodilation, so that leads to splenic vasodilation, in this case, leading to orthostatic hypotension. And with the parasympathetic drive in full gear, you have diarrhea from the GI motility being increased as well. And if among these two, the exam might also ask which is the most common. And between these two, orthostatic hypotension is even more common.
Okay, so that's the most common. And you're exactly right. Those kind of questions, which of the following is the most common complication, or what would you most expect to see, is going to be the orthostatic hypotension. Okay, so those really aren't adverse effects because they are expected effects. Orthostatic hypotension and diarrhea kind of means you did the block correctly, just kind of like the change in temperature you mentioned with the prior block we discussed, the stellate ganglion block. So we would expect to see those. What about adverse effects that we don't want to see if we do it right?
Hey, folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rock star returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC.
Okay, and now we're back with Eric Wang.
Yes, and also as a brief addition about the orthostatic hypotension, sometimes the examiner asks what is the best treatment, and it sounds really simple, but it's just IV fluid preloading. So you just preload the patient 500 to 500 milliliters to a liter before the block, and that should help, or at least mitigate that hypotension.
Great. It sounds like that we could think of this much like doing a spinal for a C-section, right, where we would expect the vasodilation from that spinal, the sympathectomy from that spinal to cause hypotension. So doing some fluid loading, maybe even start in that setting, though probably not in this one, starting some phenylephrine or norepinephrine. But basically knowing this is going to come and then pre-treating.
I think that's a great connection, yes.
Great. Okay. So how about unexpected, or not unexpected, but adverse effects that we want to try to avoid?
So some of these include the most severe one, the most dangerous one would be paraplegia from the artery of edampuvite's vasospasming from the needle itself, or even having necrosis, usually in context of doing a neurolysis in which you have the injectate spreading outside of the plexus and getting onto the artery of edampuvite's or one of its smaller branches. And because those feed into the anterior spinal cord, you can have, unfortunately, paraplegia from this. So this is something that the exam might test as well. Other complications might be retroperitoneal hematoma if you enter the kidneys, for example, or other structures along the way to the celiac plexus, or pneumothorax. And that is more common as a risk if you try to do what's called a splenic nerve block, which is a little bit more granular. I don't know whether they're going to test this on the exam, but with that block, you oftentimes approach the target from the thoracic cavity, so the lungs are in closer proximity.
Great. And then what you mentioned, let's just review, of course, the artery of Adamkiewicz, right? The famous artery, the most highly tested vessel of the body, right? So just remind us, Eric, what is that?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for us in humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift.
I love my figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all figs all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of figs is totally worth it. We're partnering with Figs to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. Figs goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try Figs today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout.
Hey there, ACRackers. Has your routine taken a hit these past couple of months with summer travel and all your other obligations? Well, if you're like me, you feel the need to get back to eating real food, and Factor makes that easy, even when you're on the go. Factor makes chef-crafted, dietitian-designed, ready-to-eat meals so you don't have to choose between real food and convenience. Factor meals are ready in 2 minutes and require no prep and no cleanup, so even on the days your schedule's completely out of control, eating well is still achievable. Every week you'll find over 100 nutrient-dense items to choose from and new options like salmon burger, shredded pork, collard greens, and more, plus add-ons you'll crave like pumpkin-flavored cheesecakes and protein shakes. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Some of our favorites right now are the shredded chicken taco bowl and the buffalo ranch burger. Let's eat real. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and one free breakfast item per box for 1 year while supplies last until 10/31/26. That's code ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com. ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com. See website for more details. Hey folks, August is the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush begins, and honestly, I can't think of a better place to start than my closet. That's why I love shopping at Quince. Quince is all about fewer, better pieces. Their clothes are made with premium materials, built to last, and designed to become the ones you reach for day after day. They specialize in everyday staples that work harder, like their ultra-soft organic cotton tees and premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters. If you're still hanging on to the same worn-out basics, Quince makes it easy to upgrade. They have premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60 with the kind of high-quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. I absolutely love the new swim trunks I got from Quince. They have a comfortable inner liner, and they look great. Even my wife and daughters give them a thumbs up, and that is a rare thing. Upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK, too. That's quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey, folks. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've ever actually talked about how much people love this service when they use it. You can check it out yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. The reviews are updated every day with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it's been to them. Please visit betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. The consistent feedback from real users makes it easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists have at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of hands-on experience. They also hold all required education, training, and certifications across a range of mental health specialties. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. That's betterhelp.com. Visit betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com. All right, and we're back talking about the artery of Adamkiewicz.
So that's one of the major branches from the aorta that supplies the anterior spinal cord. So therefore, if you have a vasospasm or if you outright damage that artery and you impede vascular flow to the anterior spinal cord, then you can have ischemia and therefore neurologic deficits in particularly the lower extremities, therefore paraplegia.
Great. Yeah. So that is highly tested just in general and then in this context as well. Okay. Other things we should know about the celiac plexus block?
Sometimes you'll see terms such as anti-crural or retrocrural. The crural in those words refers to the diaphragmatic crura. So you can do the injection by placing the needle in front or anterior to the diaphragm or posterior to the diaphragm. And I think that's just something that you'll see on the stems, but I doubt they'll actually test which technique is better. As a side note, in real life, there's not great evidence that one is better than the other. I think the most important thing is you as a practitioner, if you're a pain physician, which approach that you can do more safely, that's the best one I'd take.
Great. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about a lumbar sympathetic block. What are the indications for this one?
The classic indication for the lumbar sympathetic block is CRPS of the lower extremity. So just as we talked about, the stellate ganglion block is classically for CRPS of one of the arms. The lumbar sympathetic block is oftentimes used for CRPS of one of the legs.
Great. Okay. So CRPS of the lower extremities, you're going to think lumbar sympathetic block. What's the anatomy here we want to know?
The key anatomical points are that the plexus runs along from L2 to L4, and we usually target the plexus at L3 along the anterolateral surface of the L3 vertebral body. So if you see a question stem and they mention some kind of sympathetic block along L2 to L4 or L3, then you know that they're talking about the lumbar sympathetic block.
Great. Okay. And then that should be easy to remember. You're going, it's L2 to L4 and you're going right in the middle at L3. That's your target. All right. So what are the complications that we want to know about for this one?
The most tested complication is actually genitofemoral neuralgia, which might sound surprising, but when you do this injection, the needle has to traverse through the psoas muscle. And along the way, you might either damage or come really near to the genitofemoral nerve as it crosses through the psoas muscle. So how this usually would present on boards or in real life is that you do a lumbar sympathetic block, and then afterward, the patient says that they have this thigh or groin pain that has a burning or a numbness kind of sensation. That should clue you into genitofemoral neuralgia.
Okay. That sounds like something we really want to avoid. It sounds miserable. Anything we can do if it does happen?
I think the main thing is to try to offer the patient supportive care and to tell them that almost always the nerve itself is not transected or seriously injured, but it might have been partially anesthetized by the block simply because of its proximity to the lumbar sympathetic plexus. So usually if the patient can continue moving their hips, moving their thighs, just doing normal activities, if it's safe, perhaps seeing physical therapy, applying local anesthetic topical creams, usually within a couple of weeks, the symptoms should subside. And if they don't, definitely they should follow up with their pain physician and see whether there's something else that might be contributing to the symptoms not getting better.
Okay, great. Other complications we need to know about for the lumbar sympathetic block?
Hypotension is also something that could occur. Again, similarly with the other sympathetic blocks, you cause some degree of vasodilation with this block, but usually you don't really see as much of a distinct drop in blood pressure as you do with the celiac plexus block. So on the exam, they might say hypotension is one of the answers on a particular question, but if the question is asking about complications, I think hypotension is going to be the red herring, and the answer is really going to be about the genitofemoral neuralgia.
Okay, fabulous. And then how do we know if we were successful? Is it the same as the upper extremity where we're looking for a temperature change?
Yes, absolutely. So if you do the block correctly and you do induce the sympathetic ipsilateral lower extremity should increase in temperature, again, secondary to the vasodilation that occurs with a sympathetic block, and a temperature increase of at least 1 to 2 degrees indicates a successful block. And the higher, the better, usually. Sometimes as much as even 7 to 8 degrees Celsius of an increase would be a great marker of a successful block.
Okay. And if I remember correctly from way back when I was a resident watching these be done, you put like a almost like a sticker type thermometer on the limb. Is that right? And then it changes color when the temperature changes? Is that how you do it?
So, yes, so there are thermometers that work that way. You can also even use something very similar to what they use in the PACU. You just do a skin temperature. You do one on both legs, both lower extremities before the block. You record the temperatures on both sides, and then you record the temperatures again after the block. And you could use the same type of thermometer for the arms or the upper extremities for the stellate ganglion block as well.
Okay, great. All right, let's talk about the superior hypogastric plexus block. This one also comes up on tests. What is this one for?
Yeah, so this one is for visceral lower abdominal or pelvic pain.
And so lower down even than we talked about for the celiac plexus block?
Absolutely. So if you recall from a little bit earlier, the anatomical considerations about the celiac plexus, it receives innervation from about T5 to T12. So therefore, the innervation runs through the transverse colon. So anything distal to that in the GI system, such as the remainder of the colon and also the pelvic viscera, those organs, if you have, for example, cancer-associated pain, the superior hypogastric block, plexus block is going to be more representative of that coverage.
Okay, great. So what anatomy are we talking about here? You said this is going to be more distal, so this is like L5-S1?
Absolutely, yes. L5 to S1, and specifically it receives the afferent innervation from the rectum and the pelvic viscera we talked about. So the bladder, the uterus, and the prostate. Think about organs in that low of the body.
Okay, so lower end of the body, you mentioned some key ones, prostate cancer, uterine cancer, probably cervical cancer, I would imagine, yes. And bladder cancer. Okay, so cancer pain from the pelvis or even the distal colon. Okay, and so then we're going to do this block, and what are the potential complications?
The main complication that might show up on boards is iliac vessel injury, because you're targeting the plexus at about L5 to S1. So you're below where the aortic bifurcation is. So if you do have some vessel that you're inadvertently entering from the block, then that vessel is going to be one of the iliac vessels, whether it's the iliac artery or the iliac vein. So that might be something that the boards might ask you about. The answer is not going to be the aorta. It's going to be one of the iliac vessels. Another complication might be discitis. You can perform this procedure by going through the disc of L5 to S1, and you can entrain small bacterium or other pathogens if you were to do this technique, and you can cause a discitis. The advantage of the technique, if you're wondering why one would do this at all, is because if you go through the disc, the distance to reach the plexus is shorter. So for some practitioners, they might find it to be safer and easier and faster to go through that route. But that's just one complication to be aware of.
Okay. And now you said this is distal to the aortic bifurcation, so you can't hit the aorta. And in fact, if they gave you an aortic puncture as a complication, it would not be this block that had been done, right?
That's correct. Now, in real life, I like to say anything can happen. But in board world, I think that they're going to be looking for the iliac vessels here.
Okay, great. Yeah, I guess anybody could be off enough that they would hit something really unusual. Okay, now here's one that I am not familiar with, but tell us about the ganglion impar block.
Yes, yeah, so we used a bit of a highway analogy earlier. So this would be the end of the road, the end of the sympathetic chain. So you have the bilateral sympathetic chains in the body, and they all end at one point, which is the ganglion impar. So this is the only unpaired ganglion in the body, actually. And it's blocked for most commonly for coccidia. That's the most common and classic indication. But also, just like we talked about for the superior hypogastric plexus block, when we're targeting visceral pain from the lower abdomen, this is for pain that's from even more distal structures, like the distal rectum, almost right at the level of the anus. That's how external we're talking about. Other structures that might benefit from this block are the urethra, or the vulva, or the perineum. So think about pain that's really as close to the exterior of the body as you could think of. If you're considering between a superior hypogastric plexus block versus a ganglion impar block.
Okay, great. And so this is, as you said, this is the unpaired ganglion, the terminus, the farthest down the sympathetic chain. Where exactly is it located in terms of anatomy?
So it's so far down, it's actually right in front of the S5 coccyx junction. So you perform this procedure by actually just going through a ligament and a cartilage and the joint that connects the S5 to the coccyx. So the main complication that is actually if you were to go too anterior, then you might enter the rectum inadvertently.
Okay, because this is posterior to the rectum.
That's correct. It's between the coccyx and the rectum.
Okay, so you just can't go too far or you might hit the rectum. Okay.
That's right.
All right, now you mentioned up front the sphenopalatine ganglion block as the only one we were going to talk about that is parasympathetic. So let's talk about that. What are the indications for a sphenopalatine ganglion block?
The classic indications are cluster headaches and also migraines. But in recent years, there's been more of an interest in using it for posterior puncture headache as well, simply because the classic treatment has been epidural blood patches. But the sphenopalatine ganglion block, I think most people would agree, is much more straightforward to perform and perhaps one would say easier to perform than the epidural blood patch. So that's something that people have been using it for in recent years as well.
Okay, great. So, you know, you have to be aware of that potential use. It could come up, but the more classic are cluster headaches and migraines. And how about trigeminal neuralgia? Is it used for that?
It might, because it does connect to the trigeminal autonomic ganglion as well. But I just haven't seen it as much for that indication. And I wouldn't expect it to be one of the answer choices on the boards at this time.
Okay. And what's the theory of how it helps potentially helps posterior puncture headache?
The headache in posterior puncture headache is believed to be contributed by compensatory intracranial vasodilation that occurs when you have the leak and the CSF pressure from the puncture. So if you were to block the parasympathetic outflow, then you would cause cerebral vasoconstriction. And that vasoconstriction is believed to be what helps with the headaches theoretically.
And do we know if it actually works, or is this just kind of maybe, maybe not?
So even though I think most of us would love it to work, and I think many of us have seen it actually work in cases and anecdotally, the 2024 Multi-Society Posterior Puncture Headache Clinical Practice Guideline actually looked at this, and unfortunately, they haven't found the sphenopalatine ganglion block to have great evidence for efficacy at the population level. So at the end of the day, the epidural blood patch is still the gold standard interventional option for posterior puncture headache. Although perhaps if there's more literature down the line, maybe the sphenopalatine ganglion block can be further supported.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye out for that. What's the anatomy of this one?
The sphenopalatine ganglion is the largest extracranial parasympathetic ganglion, and it's located in the pteropalatine fossa. So the terms pterygopalatine fossa, that might be on the stem as well. And again, this is the largest parasympathetic ganglion extracranially.
Okay, and how do we get at it?
So how you perform this block is actually quite straightforward. You use a cotton tip applicator, such as a Q-tip essentially, and you soak it in local anesthetic, and you just advance it along the floor of the nose as far back as you can safely do so to the posterior nasopharyngeal wall. Usually we talk about the middle turbinate, for example, if you can reach that far, and you just let it rest there for a couple minutes, and the local anesthetic on the cotton will then just soak through the mucosa and it'll reach the ganglion eventually. Sometimes people do this block by using a spray or some kind of atomizer. That might work as well. But at the end of the day, you're relying on that mucosal diffusion to reach the ganglion. You're not actually using a needle and injecting the ganglion directly.
Okay. And what are the complications to keep in mind?
Because you are introducing something into the nose, epistaxis is the most common complication, although this is usually self-limited and doesn't require intervention apart from just holding the nose, applying pressure, maybe applying Afrin. But I doubt the boards would get to that level of granularity. You might also have numbness along the cranial nerve V2 distribution or the maxilla, and that's because the maxillary nerve actually is one of the nerves that is connected to this ganglion. So if you have numbness along the top of your maxilla, along your cheekbone, that could be a complication of this block as well.
Okay, great. Let's touch briefly upon the neurolysis. You mentioned up front that you can do a block or you can do an actual neurolysis, and that's going to give you longer acting effects. So tell us, what agents do you use for a neurolysis?
Yeah, so in clinical practice, the most common agents are alcohol and phenol. And I'll talk about the key points for both of these two for the board exams.
Great.
So for alcohol, usually we use a concentration of 50 to 100% or maybe 99%. And the key points are that it causes immediate burning pain on injection. So you have to proceed that injection with the local anesthetic block. So in practice, you actually give the local first, give it a couple minutes, make sure that the patient does have the pain relieved, and then you follow that local anesthetic block with the concentrated alcohol afterward. And another important point is that alcohol precipitates if you directly mix it with iodinated contrast. So you can't put it in the same syringe. You have to inject it sequentially, not simultaneously. A third point is that alcohol is relatively hypobaric. And the fourth point is that this is the most commonly used neurolytic agent. We use it far more in practice, and I imagine for the boards as well, compared to phenol, because alcohol is commercially manufactured. So it's ready off the shelf, whereas phenol, which we'll talk about in a second, you have to compound that.
Okay. All right. So those are the key things to know about alcohol. And now let's talk about phenol.
So for phenol, you can think of these points as sort of being opposites compared to alcohol. So just like we talked about how alcohol is causes a severe burning sensation on administration, phenol is less painful because it contains some intrinsic local anesthetic properties. And also, just as alcohol would precipitate if you mix it with contrast, phenol does not precipitate with iodinated contrast. So it's actually okay to mix it with the contrast. And the advantage actually is you can inject it and look at the spread in real time on a fluoroscopy because you can mix it simultaneously. And just as alcohol is hypobaric, phenol is often suspended in glycerin, and that mixture is hyperbaric. And lastly, we mentioned alcohol is most commonly used for neurolysis, and phenol is not. It's less commonly used because you have to compound it. But the advantage, if one wonders then why use phenol at all, is because you can oftentimes use smaller volumes. So you can perhaps theoretically decrease the risk of the spread getting onto other structures that you don't want it to get to.
Great. And then I have to ask, you know, what I remember learning initially that, oh yeah, you know, if a block works, then you might do a neurolytic injection. It seems like that should be permanent, but it's not, right? It's just longer acting. But and is that because you're not actually completely destroying the nerve? You're just kind of stunning it for a while and then it grows back or heals? Is that what happens?
I think that's one major reason. So whenever you do these injections, we oftentimes do these under fluoroscopy, sometimes under CT, but most commonly through fluoroscopy. And you can't actually see the nerve. You see the building landmarks and you know where the nerve lives, but it's really difficult to tell whether you've gotten every single strand of that nerve or plexus. So any remainders that are still there, the body's going to try to repair it. And it might take a long time. Sometimes the body never gets there, but oftentimes some degree of meaningful repair does happen and you have sensations, pain sensations, namely return.
Okay, fabulous. All right, well, Eric, this has been fabulous. Let's move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What would you recommend the audience check out for fun?
So we started off the talk talking about pain medicine and its relevance to suffering. And even though this may not be a fun read per se, I think it's a very meaningful read. And my recommendation would be the book When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. I think one of the main themes in the book is the importance of finding meaning in the midst of suffering, not just afterward or before, but even in the middle of suffering, even when we oftentimes wonder why and how you can still have meaning, even if the why itself is elusive. And not to spoil the book, but the book is written by a 36-year-old neurosurgery resident who was diagnosed with stage 4 non-small cell EGFR lung cancer in his last year residency. And the book at the end was also co-written by Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, who turns out was one of the keynote speakers at our anesthesiology meeting last year. So it's a great book, really recommend it.
Totally agree. Super well written and very, very meaningful. I'm going to balance that with a totally fun recommendation. So I'm sure I've shouted this out before, but it's been a while. And I really enjoy the podcast Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. It's Conan O'Brien from, you know, the old late night show. He's got this podcast he's now had for years. It is absolutely hilarious. And if you want some of the funniest episodes, check out, I think, the three now that he's done with Kevin Nealon as the guest. They are just laugh out loud hilarious. You don't have to know much of anything about Conan or Kevin, but just their repartee back and forth, making fun of each other is so funny. Highly, highly recommend. Check out Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, interviews with Kevin Nealon. All right, Eric, been such a pleasure. This was super high yield. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's really my pleasure.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Chidima Ikanti, Rachel Furman, and Mohammed Celeb are our production assistants and social media managers.
Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.